Welcome to the presentation of a lecture from Gnostic Radio, a free public service from Telema Press. Gnostic Radio broadcasts free lectures from the Gnostic tradition of Samael on Vior. Gnosis is the root wisdom of all the world's great religions. Gnosis is a universal doctrine containing the precise science to free the soul from suffering. To find additional information about Gnosis, such as books, videos, and online courses, or to engage in online discussions, visit our website at GnosticTeachings.org. This lecture was made possible through the generous support of listeners like you. For more information or to make a donation, visit GnosticTeachings.org. Now, with heartfelt wishes for the end of suffering, we begin the lecture. May all beings be happy. The three jewels, as we've been studying in recent lectures, you'll recall are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And these three jewels have levels of application in relation to our study of Dharma, or that wisdom which leads us to the realization of Dharma itself. We explained previously that the word Dharma has these two implications or two meanings. The first is that state of existence or consciousness within which suffering has ceased. And this is a state of cessation. A state within which the primordial nature of the mind is manifest and clear. And the second application or meaning of Dharma is the path that leads to that cessation or that experiential state. These three jewels are of the utmost importance to any being who seeks to escape from suffering, to transcend suffering, to remove themselves from all manner of suffering. In Buddhism, this is called taking refuge. This comes from the notion that when we're in the midst of suffering or pain, we need protection, we need help, we need some medicine or defender to protect us from that pain, from that suffering. So any person who enters into the stream of Buddhism, the very first thing that they do, whether a lay person or a monk, is they take refuge. And in most practices, they will take refuge. For the Buddhist, this is simply to state a prayer. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And this prayer is universal to all forms of Buddhism. But to take refuge in reality, in actuality, in truth, requires something experiential, not merely an affirmation or a belief or a prayer. The prayer, the aspiration to receive the protection of the three jewels, or to take refuge in those jewels, to have those jewels be our protection and defense, requires that we take steps consciously, experientially, to arrive at that experientially, practically. So it's not a matter of belief. It isn't a matter of just wearing robes or looking Buddhist or having a name that may be a Buddhist name or coming from that culture. To take refuge in the three jewels is something internal. It's something psychological. The outer meaning of these three jewels we've discussed previously. But what we're concerned with in Gnosis, of course, is experiential knowledge, which is the meaning of the word. Knowledge that we arrive at through our own experience, consciously. And from that point of view, we can see that these three jewels must then be something that we can experience gnostically, or in other words, through our own experience. And this is not something external to us, something that can be depended upon in relation to external phenomena. This is because we know in this teaching that any real change, any fundamental alteration of the course of our life has to be emerging from within us. Any change of circumstances, any change of physical appearances is temporary and is but illusion. Real change comes from within. Real change is psychological, is conscious. So these three jewels, where we find real refuge and real protection, are inside. They are within. Unfortunately, for us to arrive at that experience, the knowledge of that requires that we take a big step. We have to make a very supreme effort. And I say unfortunately because it is not easy. We, as Westerners especially, are always looking for the easiest way, the quickest way, the least painful way. Real gnosis of the truth of the Dharma is not acquired easily. And again, the obstacle to this is not outside of us. The obstacle to Dharma is our own mind. The only obstacle that we face in our aspiration to truly take refuge in the Buddha, or in the Dharma, or in the Sangha, is our own mind. This is because we already are taking refuge. When we hear about a teaching like this, and we are taught about a teacher or a teaching, or we experience a spiritual community to which we feel some attraction, or feel that we would like to belong to that Sangha, we have to realize first that in order to truly take refuge in an authentic Sangha, in an authentic Dharma, or an authentic Buddha, we have to first abandon the refuge that we are taking now. This is the difficulty. Right now, we already take refuge in our I, in the ego. As we are in this moment, we're taking refuge in a false sense of self, a sense of identity which is based upon wrong transformations of impressions, of phenomena, of thoughts, of feelings, of sensations. We ourselves, with our own will, have crafted a cage within which we hide and take refuge. This cage is called the ego. Sometimes we call it the mind. Sometimes we call it aggregates or psychological defects. In Christianity, they call them the seven capital sins. This false I is very complex. It has many parts. It includes our personality, which we've created in this life. And this is our name, our culture, our heritage, our experiences with our parents and teachers and friends and family. Our language, the place we live, the place we grew up, our politics. All of these things constitute this personality, which we take refuge in. By taking refuge, I mean, when we are confronted with the painful experiences of life, where do we seek solace? Where do we seek protection? Where do we seek defense from the uncertainties and anxieties of life and death? We seek protection in our pride, in our anger, in our envy, in our lust. And to our great misfortune, all of our friends and family and teachers and leaders are doing the same thing. So we believe this is life. But this is a mistaken point of view. We take refuge in our job, in having a title, in having wealth, in a degree, in a position. We take refuge in the idea of who we think we are. And we take refuge in these mental concepts because we know deep down that consciously speaking, psychologically speaking, we are naked. We are vulnerable. We are weak. It doesn't take much to break an intellectual animal. Any one of us, as a mind, as a psyche, can be broken so easily by some simple shift in circumstances in our life. And you can witness this for yourself. When you see, for example, a traffic jam, and you see how crazy people become simply because of a minor inconvenience. They will even risk their lives or risk the lives of others without care because their only thought is for their own selfish intentions. We can see how easily a mind can break just because of money. All of humanity witnessed the weak-minded people who committed suicide when the stock market crashed. This is really sad that someone would kill themselves because of this illusion that we call money. There are innumerable examples that illustrate the weakness that we have in our current state. But unfortunately, rather than dealing with that weakness directly and finding a true source of strength upon which we can rely completely, we fabricate a sense of self, which we piece together based on little cultural elements that we're attracted to, because we believe they will give us security. The main one in these times is money. We have this mistaken notion that money gives us security against the uncertainties of life. And this is an extremely pervasive and very powerful illusion. We believe that if we have a certain quantity of money, that somehow this will shield us from problems, from stress, from anxiety, from worry. We do not deny that money is a tool that can be utilized to solve certain types of problems. But in itself, it is simply a tool. The question is not whether we have money or not. The question is our psychological relationship to it. The psychological dependence upon money is a form of slavery. Psychological slavery, which we welcome because we believe that feeling that we get from having money is a genuine sense of security. But it is just an illusion. We take refuge in this sense of self, the personality behind which hides many conflicting desires, because we've not yet understood what we really are, what we really have within. We've been misled. We've been mistaken. To really take refuge in the three jewels, we have to go beyond the literal external meanings of these words. We have to realize that these three jewels are within us. And as we discussed in a previous lecture, to do that, we first study the Dharma. We study the teaching itself. The teaching which leads to that cessation of pain, cessation of doubt and fear, vulnerability and anxiety, the cessation of all forms of suffering. We study that state through the path which leads to it. And as we activate and utilize that Dharma within us, we start to understand what the Sangha really means. And that, of course, is those initiates who have actually experienced and are experiencing and actualizing the Dharma in themselves. Awakened initiates, in other words. Angels, devas, buddhas, bodhisattvas. By whatever name. These are beings who are awakening consciousness. Eliminating ego. Becoming pure. And once we understand that practically, experientially, through our own experience of it, we can then start to see or grasp something of what the Buddha is. So in our path towards the state of freedom, we start with the Dharma. However, in taking refuge, things work a little bit differently. When we take refuge in ourselves to find the three jewels within, we're looking at a deeper level of meaning of the three jewels. And in this context, we can't start with the Dharma. It can't be our first place to look for refuge in ourselves, because we don't have the truth yet. We don't know the truth yet. We're trapped in the ego. We're trapped in misperception, mistaken views, the delusion that somehow this I exists. This Dharma that we learn becomes clouded by our very mind. The Dharma that we acquire as we seek to comprehend what Dharma is, when we internalize that Dharma, it's unreliable because of our own mind. This is why so many study Dharma, study knowledge, study teachings, and become confused and become misled and in turn mislead others. So we can't rely on the Dharma itself in ourselves when we look at it in this deeper way. Likewise, we can't ultimately rely on the Sangha. Any member of a Sangha can fall. Any member of a Sangha can be mistaken. Because likewise, they are not Buddhas yet. They also have mistaken view, wrong perception, and are with that mistaken view and can mistakenly lead others. So when we're looking for that internal jewel to take refuge in, we have to go directly to our own inner Buddha. It's our own inner Buddha where we have to take refuge. But again, this is not a basis of belief. This is not just a prayer that we repeat mechanically. This is something we have to experience. This is something that we have to actualize from moment to moment to make real. Not just to think about this. Not just to put together a theoretical or conceptual picture of what Dharma, Buddha, and Sangha are. But instead, to actually take refuge. This is very important for us to understand clearly. Without understanding this, all of these studies are meaningless. All the studies of Kabbalah and Dream Yoga and alchemy and Tantra are meaningless if you do not understand what it means to take refuge in the Buddha now. Of course, to do that, we have to know what that Buddha is and how to access it. Not just theoretically, practically, experientially, to be able to do this. So what is that Buddha? In the Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra, which is a tantric teaching, one of the five given by the Buddha Maitreya, the Buddha Maitreya taught very clearly about these three jewels, about the nature of the Buddha, and how we reach and access this. To understand something about the Buddha, I'll read you a short passage from this scripture. Buddha is without beginning, middle, or end. He is peace itself, fully self-awakened and self-expanded in Buddhahood. Having reached this state, he shows the indestructible, permanent path so that those who have no realization may realize. Wielding the supreme sword and vajra of knowledge and compassionate love, he cuts the seedling of suffering and destroys the wall of doubts along with its surrounding thicket of various views. I bow down to this Buddha. Being uncreated and spontaneously present, not a realization due to extraneous conditions, wielding knowledge, compassionate love, and ability. Its nature is without beginning, middle, or end. This is within us. This state is related to the Dharma Dhatu, the absolute, shunyata, the void, the emptiness. This is a vibrant reality which is inside, not outside. When we study emptiness, the absolute, the Buddha, our mind will tend to think of that as something outside of us, as something unreachable, impossible, inconceivable. It is inconceivable, but it is not impossible. We can experience the state of our own inner Buddha in his ultimate depth. And the clue is given in that scripture. Spontaneous awareness. Uncontrived. Uncreated. In this instant, empty your mind of everything. Become a pure perceiver. Only perceiving, not thinking, not remembering, not looking forward or back, just looking. Become fully and engagingly aware of all of your senses simultaneously, your entire body, and draw in all of that sensation, visual, auditory, tactile, everything. Become pure perception without thought. And you begin to feel something. Something new. Something different. It might feel a little weird. A little unusual. But this state of active, spontaneous, uncontrived perception is the doorway. This is the doorway where you can take experiential refuge in your own Buddha, who's within you. And this is because our own inner Buddha has planted within us his nature. The Buddha nature. The Buddhatvadhatu. Tathagatagarbha. The essence. The consciousness. The consciousness, the free consciousness, the essence, is completely pure. The free consciousness that we have has no fear. It has no anger. It has no pride. It is beyond suffering. It is the primordial, natural state of the mind. It is perfect peace, serenity, compassion, love, wisdom. All of those virtues are naturally radiant within the consciousness. Unfortunately, the consciousness, our consciousness, has become trapped in that mistaken sense of self. Our false self, which has our name, which has our memories, our experiences, our doubts, our fears, all of our animal desires. It's become trapped. Yet, even being trapped, it remains pure. This is extremely important to grasp. Even when the consciousness is trapped in the ego, the consciousness itself is pure, undefiled. And every one of us has that within. This is the place to take refuge. Open up your imagination And in the field of your mind's eye, imagine an immense city with lots of different neighborhoods, lots of different types of areas, some pretty, some scary, some poor, some rich. And this city is populated by tens of thousands of individual entities who go about their business. This city is your own mind. And in the midst of this busy, busy place, with all the rushing around and activity, and all the different types of desires and memories and remembrances and worries and hopes for the future that inhabit this city, in the middle, in an alley, in the trash, is a baby crying alone. And that baby is you. It's your own consciousness, the essence, which has been abandoned and forgotten. This is why we suffer. That baby is the Buddhatta, the Buddha nature. That baby represents our own inner development as a soul. We're in the very beginning stages of developing ourselves, and we are very weak and terrified, naked and afraid, hungry. It's our job, our duty, our responsibility to care for that child who's inside of us. That child is our own awareness, our own consciousness, the embryo of our soul, the embryo of a Buddha. When we use the consciousness, when we begin to take care of it, to pay attention, to not be a victim of this chaotic psychological city, to not just be caught up in all the conflicting desires and dramas that happen in this psychological city of ours, but when instead we strengthen that child through awareness, through attention, through transmutation, through meditation, the child becomes strong and quickly. That child can grow very fast, provided we take the time and make the effort. The child of our consciousness can develop rapidly, and we can very quickly begin to experience the true refuge that the consciousness can provide to us. It's something that we talked about in the last lecture. This space of serenity, a psychological environment within which we can experience great peace even when our circumstances are not peaceful. This does not arise mechanically by evolution or by chance. It only arrives by will, by the causes that we ourselves set up. This is the first requirement to take refuge. And this is to begin awakening our consciousness. And this awakening of our consciousness is not in a future time. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It happens now as we activate and utilize the consciousness that we have. And this is, in simple terms, to exercise right will, to take psychological control, to take control of our mind, to not allow our mind to control our consciousness, but to take control of it, to take control of ourselves. This first shows, or first needs to be done here and now, physically, in your physical body, in all your activities, whether they're exciting or dull, to direct the course of your own consciousness by will. This is done in synthesis by learning how to be in conscious control of our three brains, to establish a permanent center of gravity in the consciousness. In other words, we no longer allow ourselves to be taken off into thoughts by the thinking mind, by the intellect. We also never allow ourselves to be swept away by emotions in the emotional brain. And thirdly, we don't allow ourselves to be swept away by instinctive, motor, or sexual impulses related to the third brain. In other words, in any given moment, in any given time or place, no matter what the intellect says, no matter what our heart is saying, no matter what our instincts or motor mechanical behaviors or sexual desires are saying, we take conscious control and do what we know is right. It's that simple. To listen to the conscience. The conscience is part of the consciousness. Consciousness is our ability to perceive. Pure perception. Conscience is our ability to perceive what is right and wrong. And this is related to intuition. When we learned this, we call it psychological equilibrium. Psychological equilibrium. This is a state of psychological balance. And in this state of balance, we, as a consciousness, can very well manage all of the impulses that arise in our three brains consciously. Even with a powerful impact, we do not lose control of our mind. This is the challenge. Even when you're stuck in traffic, or somebody cuts you off on the road, or somebody is rude, or somebody does something treacherous to you, or you have a great defeat in business or life, or you have a great success. In any case, you maintain your psychological equilibrium. You maintain conscious observation and control over your three brains. This is the definition of a fourth type of person. An equilibrated person. A person who has achieved psychological balance. Without this, we cannot go further. It's not possible. You can't go beyond and go into levels of initiation, levels of awakening in the internal worlds until you can command your mind here and now in the physical world. We have to take conscious control of ourselves. Once we are establishing that, making it consistent. Not perfect. The perfection of it's not there until we're completely done, completely awakened. But once we've made some progress, we've made this equilibrium consistent, we can go further into deeper and more profound levels of taking refuge. But these deeper levels have requirements that are fundamental in the functioning of nature. These requirements are related to tantra. A single person can do this work, can work on their own consciousness, can establish themselves in psychological equilibrium, can meditate deeply and transform themselves, eliminating many of those defects that inhabit the mind. They can awaken their consciousness a great deal and achieve a great deal of realization, comprehension of Dharma. But there's a certain limit beyond which a single person cannot proceed. To go beyond that point, beyond the initiations of minor mysteries, they need to enter into the tantric mysteries of sexual cooperation. In other words, they need to be born again. They need to create something new, a new kind of vessel, a new kind of vehicle. A couple, man and woman, working towards chastity or complete transmutation of the sexual force can go beyond. And this is because the sexual energy that exists within us has to be transformed and utilized in the dharmic way, in the tantric way, to conquer desire, to conquer the animal that's within. To synthesize that process, we say that there are a series of initiations that the consciousness has to go through. It is the consciousness who faces the ordeals, the difficulties, the challenges, the tests, and who has to overcome the ordeals and challenges and tests in order for the inner being, the inner Buddha, to receive the initiations, to receive the advancement, to receive the gifts. These initiations are related to the Tree of Life, and to describe them in detail would require many, 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 many lectures. But in simple terms, these initiations begin with the physical world, with the physical body, and gradually, step by step, the initiate marches consciously inwards from body to body, from level to level, from dimension to dimension. All the while facing himself, facing the truth of the false sense of self, and overcoming it. Once we dominate consciously ourselves physically, and we're making consistent our psychological control in this physical world, we extend that into the astral world. We begin to establish this consciousness in our dreaming, when the physical body is resting, You can't awaken and sustain and manage your psychological equilibrium in the astral world if you cannot do it in the physical world. You start here, physically. You work physically. It's hard, but it can be done. Once you've begun working in the astral world, the requirement is that you learn how to consciously control your astral presence, your astral consciousness. We don't say astral body, because we have to create that first. And even a single person can be working to dominate their astral experience. They cannot create an astral body. In Tibetan Buddhism, this is called the body of illusion, the illusory body. There's one that has to be destroyed and one that has to be created. From there we go deeper to the mental body, the body of thought. And the same process ensues to develop conscious psychological equilibrium in the mental world. And from there we go beyond that into the causal plane to develop conscious domination over our causal experience. These may sound very far away from you, but they are not. When you're in your physical body, your other bodies are present. All of these aspects of our physiology interpenetrate. When you're in your physical body and you experience the sensation of thought, you're seeing the reflection of your mental world, your mental body. In our case, it's lunar, mechanical, protoplasmic. The emotions that we feel and sense are related to the lunar astral body, the kamarupa, body of desire. These are real vehicles, vessels, that we experience physically through our thoughts and feelings. We begin dominating them here physically by learning to be conscious of ourselves physically and to manage our psychological centers physically. And later we go deeper into those worlds to dominate those parts of our psyche more directly. In synthesis, it's necessary for us to create solar vessels, solar bodies. These are vehicles of a superior nature, created through the process of Tantra, which is transmutation of the sexual energy in accordance with the will of the Buddha. And these are the seven serpents that we see over the head of the Buddha when he's threatened by the flood. When Mukalinda comes to help him, this is the Naga King, the Kundalini serpent, the Divine Mother, who protects him from the floodwaters and the rain. The Buddha was taking refuge in his solar bodies, in his Divine Mother. This is the symbol from the life of the Buddha. This is how we develop the ability, the capacity to take refuge ourselves. These seven serpents are related with these first seven spheres on the Tree of Life. When we develop that psychological equilibrium and we begin to create those solar bodies, they are armor. That's why they're called To Soma Heliakon, the body of gold of the solar man. These are armor. They're symbolized in that opera Carmen by Bizet, by the toreador who wears his splendorous suit of gold, the torero, right? The toreador, I mean. And he's the one who fights the bull, the ego. But the toreador is always dressed very well and has a sword. And he symbolizes the soul, the human soul, the consciousness dressed in its vesture, the wedding garment, the solar bodies, the armor of the warrior. That armor provides protection, refuge. But only if we use them consciously. To arrive at this state, to arrive at this position of having created the solar bodies, is actually easy. The difficulties haven't even begun yet. To create those solar vessels is only the very, very beginning of the work. It's only the first portion of the first mountain, and there are three mountains. The first mountain is the mountain of initiation, which consists of seven serpents of fire and the serpents of light. These are two great processes. In the first, the solar bodies are created through tantrism. In the second, the solar bodies are purified and prepared to enter into the second mountain. But in order to go to that point, there's a great decision that has to be made. And this is related to the sphere of Tiferet, the human soul itself, the consciousness itself, the Buddha nature. When we have developed the solar astral, solar mental, and solar causal bodies, we face a choice. To take the spiral path or the direct path. In other words, to continue on as a Pratyeka Buddha or to continue on as a Bodhisattva. These are very different. The Pratyeka Buddhas become Nirvanis, Arhats, or initiates who've awakened consciousness to a certain percentage, who've created the solar bodies, and who have acquired a certain degree of refuge from suffering in nirvana. And they stay there, working slowly and gradually, little by little, to free themselves more. And this is a good path. It's a path of love. It's a path of compassion. But there's a greater path. The direct path departs from Tiferet. And it's from here that the initiate can go through the serpents of light and then on to the second and third mountains. Only the bodhisattvas can do this. This path is very difficult and very painful and presents a requirement upon the initiate which is nearly unbearable. And that is simply to pay the entirety of one's karma now. The karma that we've acquired throughout all of our previous lives to be paid immediately. The reason to do this is because of the Buddha. The decision that's made at this juncture of the development of the consciousness is a decision that must be made by our inner Buddha, by the one who's within. And it depends upon his dharma, his truth. That inner Buddha and his own idiosyncrasy. Over the course of this humanity, there have been many, many initiates who have entered into the spiral path, who've become awakened initiates, who've become Buddhas of Nirvana. An uncountable number who've entered into that good work and who've acquired some experience of the cessation of suffering. But there have been very few who've had the strength, the endurance to take the straight path. And thus, there are not very many bodhisattvas in the full meaning of the word. And here we differentiate between the two primary meanings of this word. There are many who aspire towards the bodhisattva path, who take bodhisattva vows, and who teach and speak of the bodhisattva work. And this is good and useful. And many nirvanis speak of this, many pratyeka buddhas, and walkers of the Shravakayana. But it's very few who actually become that in the full meaning of the word. Very few. We can only name some. Krishna, Moses, Jesus, some of the Dalai Lamas, probably all the Dalai Lamas. Milarepa, Guru Rinpoche, the Buddha. The great ones, really. The greatest leaders, the greatest messengers were walkers of the straight path, the direct path. And that's how they acquire those great realizations, great insights into nature. This is why we have to go a little further into our understanding of Sangha. Because the Sangha has two broad levels. There's the Sangha of Nirvanis, of those awakened initiates who've acquired some experience of Nirvana and some awakening, but do not experientially know the path of the Bodhisattva. Therefore, they cannot teach it. They may speak of it. They may refer to it. They may talk about it. But they cannot teach it experientially because they don't walk on it. The second group of Sangha are those Bodhisattvas themselves, who are always revolutionary, who are always controversial, who are always betrayed. This is the nature of that path. The walkers of the Bodhisattva path face all the greatest difficulties, all the greatest ordeals, all the greatest sufferings, but they will also receive the greatest triumph. The walker of the Bodhisattva path is the only one that can go on to fully awaken the Buddha within, to its highest degree. The walker of the Bodhisattva path is the only one that can go on to become a Nirmanakaya, a Sambhogakaya, a Dharmakaya. These three kayas are related to the three highest degrees of development, the three top spheres on the tree of life. These three degrees are reached after resurrection. In other words, the initiate mirrors the drama of the Christ. The initiate passes through all the suffering and terrible ordeals that Jesus passed through, and that all the other great initiates passed through. And then he dies. When he dies, the body of liberation is born. This is the rainbow body. This is the beginning of the three kayas. And this is where the initiate enters into the third mountain. Previous to reaching this, the initiate, from the moment of choosing the direct path to the moment of completing the second mountain, has to eliminate the entirety of the false sense of self. The entire ego, all karma. This is very difficult. It's symbolized by the 12 labors of Hercules. The many superhuman works that have to be performed. These three kayas, Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, Dharmakaya, are the ultimate Sangha. This is the Sangha of the resurrected masters, the highest initiates in the cosmos, the true Rosicrucians, Maitreya, Guru Rinpoche, Moses, Krishna, Samael. Jesus is the head. Chinrezi, Avalokiteshvara, the cosmic Christ. The Dharmakaya itself is the ultimate expression or ultimate vehicle of this level of Sangha. And the Dharmakaya is the truth body. But it's invisible to us. So we don't know the truth. These great bodhisattvas, for again, only bodhisattvas can reach these levels, use their lower bodies, which in their conjunction are called the rupakaya, the bodies of form. They use these manifestation bodies to assist us. Because this is the very purpose of a bodhisattva, to serve, to sacrifice, to help. These three kaya, the seeds of them, the potential for them, is inside of your own Buddha nature. Any person, any being, can develop and elaborate and realize the nature of their own Dharmakaya, their own formless body, truth body. Anyone with sufficient will. But this is not just an idea. It's not just a theory. We have to reach it through our experience. The Dharmakaya is the body that the Buddha uses in the absolute, in the emptiness, in the no thing. And our own inner Buddha, in its nature, in its essence, is the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is nothing that can be conceived. It cannot be explained. It cannot be seen. It has no beginning. It has no end. It is perfect serenity, perfect peace, the ground of existence, and yet non-existence. Inside of our own Buddha nature is the doorway to our own Dharmakaya. In the innermost level of meanings of the three jewels, the Buddha is the Dharmakaya. The Dharma is the Sambhogakaya. The Sangha is the Nirmanakaya. These three are within us. These are all the parts of our being made perfect. This is not just a dream. It is the very tip of the arrowhead of Dharma. The very point. The very meaning at which we aim. Gnosis itself, this teaching, is the Dharma taught by the Buddha, Samael. That Dharma is maintained and expressed by the Sangha of Gnosis, which are all those initiates who are actualizing that teaching in themselves, not just the ones who believe in it, or who follow it, or who lay claim to it, but the ones who are doing it. In other words, the Gnostic Dharma is the teaching of the direct path. It is not a teaching of the spiral path. It is not a teaching to be toyed with or to be taken lightly. It is very serious. In one of his books, Samael warned, "Stay back, profaners." Gnosis is a two-edged sword. The meaning of that is, if we don't use it in the right way, it can actually harm. This teaching is very profound and has to be understood in the right way. These three aspects that we discussed to reach the full knowledge of our own Buddha, to take refuge in our own inner Buddha, are first to awaken our consciousness, to learn how to use it. Second, to enter into and pass through all the required initiations. And third, to reach resurrection and go beyond it. These three synthesize a lifetime of work. They collect together volumes upon volumes of knowledge, which you have to acquire for yourself through your own experience. The only obstacle you face is yourself. Learn to see the illusion of your eye. Learn to take refuge in your Buddha nature, which is empty. This can't be emphasized enough. The true nature of your mind is empty. It is clear. It is open. It is silent. Another word for the Dharmakaya, or for the Absolute, is clear light. Clear light is not literal. It's a descriptive term of an experience of reality. Samael and Vior called this the illuminating void, the absolute. This is the ultimate nature of our mind, which is one with the Dharmakaya. Your thoughts are not who you are. Your name is not who you are. Your memories, your desires. The only limitations you have are self-created. Your Buddhatta is limitless in its essence, in its nature. It is a vast expanse of emptiness and clarity and love. When you do battle against your own mind, this knowledge can be a great refuge. But it has to become Dharma, your own Gnostic Dharma, experienced Dharma. I had an experience recently in the astral plane, in the mental plane actually, fighting against a very powerful warrior who was terrifying in his appearance, very strong. And I noticed that when in my experience I believed he was real, I couldn't cut him with my weapon. But when I consciously recalled that this entity that I was fighting was empty of inherent existence, was an illusion of my own mind, I could cut him. I could defeat him. And I did. But it was only that knowledge, consciously remembering, looking at him in that level of existence and remembering he is not real. This knowledge can work to help you transform your mind. But it requires that you become fully conscious of it. When you do so, you can take full conscious refuge in these three jewels in yourself. Any questions?
When a person is working on himself or herself and go through certain ordeals and pass them, can those same ordeals, can they go through that same ordeal again but only on a different level?
Absolutely. Our ordeals and problems often move in octaves. But you have to be very careful about this. If we face a challenge, an ordeal, a difficulty, which is given to us to help us change, if we pass that, we really, truly change, sincerely. We may face a similar challenge afterward, but it'll be slightly different. This is good. We shouldn't take it like we failed. We should take the ordeal and keep working. The problem comes when we think we failed or when we think we succeeded. It's necessary for us to not evaluate with the ego our own progress. It might happen that we did actually fail and the ordeal is simply repeating again. That can happen too. Either way, it doesn't really matter if we passed it or failed it. The fact is, we're facing the ordeal again. We have no choice but to face it again and do better. The speculation about, am I passing, am I failing, is simply a speculation of pride. And we have to reject that and be. Another question.
It's my sort of seminal real estate and being yoga that the mind is a receptive instrument and not an active one. That statement alone is so powerful. Like if you just remember yourself with that statement alone, right? And receive impressions, one comes in, one flips out. Now, through all these years of meditation and working on myself, I sort of got a taste of quieting the mind, right? And what happens is, it seems the ego even lets go sometimes. It says, okay, here, you want a taste of this, right? And it's a fear of, you know, getting a taste of this consciousness, you know? It's like, you don't know what to do. It's like having an amnesia, like, almost, you know? So is that really a taste of consciousness, or is it really still the ego saying, okay, here, you know, here's this fear still of even letting go of this, you know?
The ego has many levels. You can meditate and act and access experiences in meditation and still have the ego there, even in that experience. There are levels of the mind. And while we may acquire silence in one level of the mind, in other levels of the mind, there will be activity, just more subtle. So we have to not identify. This is the difficulty. To learn how to do that is purely experiential. The basis of it is to withdraw your consciousness from the element that's identified. And there are a lot of antidotes and techniques that you can apply to that, that the Master Samael taught in books like The Revolution of the Dialectic. Fear is a difficult one, because the vibration of fear is so strong and deep. So when you encounter accessing a state of meditation or wanting to, and fear is an obstacle, I propose to you that you simply turn and meditate on that fear. No longer seek the experience of silence. Don't look for it. Meditate on the fear. And that way, eventually, you'll remove that fear and it won't be an issue anymore. In truth, in reality, the entire process of taking refuge in the three jewels is a process of meditation. When I talk about needing to dominate the physical body and the three brains and to develop psychological equilibrium, it's impossible to do that if you don't meditate. It's flat impossible. Meditation is the entire basis of gnosis. And if you don't meditate, if you don't understand meditation, teach yourself how to do it. And this is the ultimate revelation about it. No one can teach you to meditate. No one. And any genuine teacher of meditation knows that. Any true master of meditation knows. They cannot teach you how to do it. You have to teach yourself. It's internal. It's psychological. It's a work with the consciousness, which cannot be made theoretical, and it cannot be made conceptual. As soon as you make it conceptual, you've lost it. Meditation has nothing to do with thought. As soon as you have thought, "I am meditating," you are not. The question is, can meditation be guided from outside? No. And this is why. Meditation is an internal process, which is related to the consciousness. To access the true state of meditation, we have to abandon the physical body 100%. If you're still listening through your ears for guidance, you will remain in your physical body. Therefore, you will not access samadhi. It's simple. The Master Samael wrote in a very beautiful way about the experience of meditation and about the experience of reality, which is the emptiness, in many of his books, especially Cosmic Teachings of a Lama. And also the book about education. This experience of shunyata is possible for any student at any level. The obstacle is your own mind, and that's all. If you have sufficient courage to abandon thinking, to abandon norms, to abandon concepts and opinions, to become pure perception, introverted, and abandon even the physical world, but remain perfectly cognizant of the empty space between your thoughts. You can penetrate directly into that empty space and experience your own Dharmakaya, your own Buddhadhatu. Your primordial original state, which is happiness. This does not require any fancy technique. It doesn't take years and years of meditation. It doesn't take a book or a teacher. You can arrive at it in an instant. But you have to know how to cultivate the proper conditions for that experience to arise, and that's all inside of you.
You say, "Well, I got to work on myself tomorrow because today is the 16th, or today is the new moon, or you know, today is the you know, whatever bad number, whatever day it is, you know, connected with some type of quote unquote bad number. So it doesn't matter what day it is, it doesn't matter the state of the moon or what have you. It's bottom line is as soon as you receive the teachings, you know how true it is just to work on yourself.
Yeah, we have a lot of mistaken ideas about when we should or should not work on ourselves. And in reality, they're all excuses, evasions. The mind always seeks evasions, ways to avoid us seeing the truth of it. And there are innumerable examples of that, be they astrological or theoretical or religious. Real gnosis arrives when we awaken our consciousness now. No matter what's happening, no matter what day it is, whether it's day or night, whether we're sick or healthy, young or old. The inheritance that we have in our consciousness is there, waiting. And if we stop ourselves from retrieving it, we have only ourselves to blame. Is there another question back there? I would agree with that 100%. The statement was that, do I believe that many students are preoccupied with finding a spouse when instead they should be working on their mind? There's no question about it. It's true that in Tantra, the importance of a spouse is paid particular attention. And this is because that relationship brings elements which are very necessary for our development. But there's an important thing to remember. We're here to take refuge in our own inner Buddha, not a marriage, not anything temporal or physical. This physical body will come and go. It will die. Any marriage will come and go. Any situation in life will come and go. Our own inner Buddha is always there. And in fact, he's the one who directs the course of how we pay our karma. If in our particular work we happen to be single, it's because that's what we need. We should simply accept that. It doesn't mean that you should sit still and not socialize, or not be open to the possibility of a relationship. You have to always have an open mind. But you have to always remember, who are you taking refuge in? Your desires or the direction of your innermost? Is there another question? Okay. Thank you. The presentation of this lecture was made possible by donations from listeners like you. Help humanity discover the sacred wisdom that leads to liberation from suffering. Make a donation to Telema Press. Visit GnosticTeachings.org for details. Thank you for your support. May all beings be happy.